Welcome to the Italy panel. I'm Professor Mark Choate, Professor of History here at Brigham Young University, and I will be the moderator. Part of the discussion will be in Italian. The language tracks are on the wall behind us. And we'll proceed in alphabetical order, starting off with Claudio Maria Betti. Dr. Betti is a historian and teaches in Rome and at the Pontifical University Serafico, and is the an advisor to the Italian Ministry of Health and assistant to the president of Comunità di Sant'Egidio. And each presentation will be approximately 12 minutes. And I'll introduce the next two. Yeah. Yes, of course. Dr. Betti.
Thank you very much. I would like to start by giving a title to this presentation of mine. And yesterday I thought a lot about it, and I came out with a title that could sound a little bit like this: In Search of the Missing S. Why? Let me do something that much more important people before me have done. Let's try to go back to the title of the conference. When I read the title of the conference, it was Religion and Human Rights. I read Religion and Human Rights, but I really understood religions and human rights. That small s has an extreme importance. And I will try to understand why. Is it a slip that can be because I completely lost my English? Or is it because it's caused by a profound belief that in reality puts me at odds with a lot that has been said in these days? Let me begin also by saying why you should listen to me, because I'm not a lawyer. I do not know anything about law. I'm sorry. I do not work on an NGO that deals with human rights. I'm an historian. I teach international relations and conflict resolution. But I've been working for more than 30 years now with the other part of the equation, which is the religions, and not religion, but religions. I met thousands of religious leaders, thousands, and from all traditions, and most of all, from all level of orthodoxy, I don't know. During our conference yesterday and today, I tried to place some of the people I met in these years in our conference. And I frankly had some difficulty imagining them fitting into our group and sharing most of all our comments and even in some cases understanding them. Now, I know I can be a little bit controversial. I'm Italian, guys. You have to accept that Italians are not very politically correct. And this is... And unfortunately, I think I have taken all the Italian part. I left all my Italian. I didn't leave my Italian in Italy. I'm not talking about the people that normally take part to these meetings. There are a lot of them. But I'm speaking more about those people like that Professor Koo yesterday spoke about. They're the members of the government of Malaysia who said something on religion and on the relationship between religions and human rights, which was terrible. And we are right to be scandalized by what they say. Unfortunately, however, most of the people I met in these 30 years of life would have probably said the same. Our friend Tore from Norway said something similar regarding the Cairo the Cairo Declaration, saying that most of the Islamic religious leaders he had met would not share most of what the Cairo Declaration says. And I have, unfortunately, to agree with him, and not only on the Islamic part. I would say it is also possible also on many other religious traditions, and surely I talk as a Catholic in the Catholic Church. Now, Professor Asher, Mods Asher from Israel, rightly says that we have to convince the people that there is no contradiction between religion and human rights. And only then we can use religion. But with this expression, of course, you can immediately understand that we have already found the S. It was amazing for me how easily it was to pass from religion and human rights to religions and human rights, meaning with religions, a theoretical idea, while on the other side, with religions, we are speaking about concrete life of individuals. This morning it was very clear in some of the explanation, but yesterday it was even clearer. The contrast is often not between religion as a theoretical word that floats in the air and human rights. It is mostly between concrete people who live concrete lives in concrete problems. And as you know, being some member of Sant'Egidio makes me almost a little bit fixated with concreteness. We are really fixated. And often, I always feel that in my history, I always had the desperate necessity of putting a test theories with the fire of history in order for them to find a credibility. I think that there is the need of theorization. But there is, on the other side, the need of being extremely adherent to reality. One of the difficulties, in fact, that we meet in engaging with religions and not with religion is that of our language. David Little yesterday spoke very clearly about the human right language. And I think that it's true. There is a human right language that has its language, its own framework of value. And it appears to me that this language, however, is mostly unknown or at least not easily understandable by religious actors. Let me dwell a bit on this issue of language. Because I think we need to understand this from where this difficulty comes from. We need to set a framework. In spite of the theory, in fact, that quite popular in the 70s, that religions were declining and would soon disappear, this is typical Jacques Dalumeau. La Christianese va-t-il mourir? Well, it was going to end. Well, today we see a revival of faith, all faiths all over the world, in the context of different cultures and economic situations. This is what this French scholar Gilles Kepel calls the revenge of God, the revanche de Dieu. This religious revival began in the final decades of the last century, and it runs through all religious worlds, particularly Christianity and Islam. And even in Christianity in different denominations, just read Philip Jenkins in the Third Church. And Jan Linden today spoke about identity. It was just a few moments ago. And I agree. There is religions today answer to a crisis of identity, which can be created by everything, but is clearly created by a globalization that has become so pervasive that puts in crisis identities at all costs. I would say, using the words of Fedan Todorov, l'homme des pays, I'm sure, unfortunately, there is no English book for that book, but it's probably one of the most beautiful books. Globalization has created a man who has lost its bearings. And religions are those things that enable men and women, of course, to find their bearings again. Now, why? Because there is a sentiment of fear that stems from in individuals and peoples, feelings that are profoundly imbued in the concrete reality of the world. Bauman speaks of liquid fear, so liquid that it's difficult to understand, rising from the loss of one's own references. And they become a fear that encompasses all aspects of life. That is why I think religions have a peculiar language. Because it is not a language that answers a structure, like it could be the language of human rights. It answers to the profound fears of human soul. How do you speak to the human soul? Can the human right language speak to the human soul? And I think that, unfortunately, the answer is no. Not at least the way we are framing it. Religions, I think, have their own anthropological structures and path, And if we analyze them in purely secular instruments, from the point of view of modern and secular societies, we are bound to miss the point, or to favor only those religious instances that agree with us, missing the largest part of the religious world. I'm saying, if we want to talk with religions, we have to talk with everyone, and not with just those who understand us, who are definitely a minority. I mean, who would understand? I'm sorry to say, to insist on that. What the language of a Cairo declaration, only those who have heard about it and only those who work on it. Very few others are able to do that. Not because they do not have the ability, but because no one has ever spoken to them about it. No religious leaders. I may be discovering water. That's the way the Italians say when something is so stupid that it doesn't need to be. Scoprire l'acqua calda, no? Discovering hot water. But there is a complexity in dealing with religions that needs to be understood. We need to avoid religions to be a sort of a new toy, the new toy of the international community. This happens to me. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm saying this to people who are experts in law, but if you work in the conflict resolution or in the development world, everything is religions and conflict resolution, religions and development, religions and. It looks often like a new toy. We're missing the point there. It is not a new toy. Again, debate is crucial. Philosophical debate is essential. In Italiano è filosofia del diritto. Non so come si dica, ma in inglese. Philosophy of law is crucial. The need to draw lines and theories cannot be avoided. But unless these can be understood, unless these can be shared, and now let me say, cherished even, not only by a group of few enlightened people, but by most, we will not be able to harvest the full potential of religions. On the contrary, we will find in them a great hindrance. We have heard about it. There are some issues in the plenary. Let me give you an example, a very clear one. Of the language. We are talking about the intervention in Syria. The President Obama calls for intervention in Syria, and I quote, in order to punish the guilty and retribution. Hillary Clinton goes on and says, what makes credible the opening of Damascus is that they take place under the threat of the military intervention. This is on one side. These are the wording of the international community on Syria. On the other side, we have the Pope, who talks on, in the silence of the cross, the uproar of weapons ceases, and the language of reconciliation, forgiveness, and dialogue and peace is spoken. Immediately you see how these two worlds are difficult to reconcile if we use these languages that are so far away. On one side, retribution, on threat, and on the other side, mercy, forgiveness, reconciliation, dialogue, and peace. Of course, we cannot think that they both cherish peace. Of course, they both cherish dialogue. And I wouldn't think that the Pope is happy for what is happening in Syria. I mean, I don't think so. Well, I know he doesn't. But at the same time, I think that we need to understand that there is this difference that eventually makes the dialogue between these two aspects of life so completely difficult. I think that, however, and now the positive aspects. I'm just saying only bad things. Religions are a reservoir of spirituality and humanity. In the world ruled by fear, men and women of faith who are withdrawn from materialism and may preserve the spiritual dimension, they can give a soul to society. Men and women of religions, when they're rooted in the true roots of their faith, can be men and women of peace and reconciliation. Just give you a couple of quotations. Saint Seraphim of Sarov says, obtain, and he knew very little about human rights. I mean, it was much earlier than the Human Rights Declaration, says, obtain peace within you and thousands around you will find it. The Rabbi Hillel, he too, not quite used to human rights being first century, said, when you see no human around you, you have to strive to be human. But again, the Mishnah and the Gemara in Tractate Sanhedrin speak about the truth. In man was created as a single individual, as a single individual, to teach us that anyone who destroys a single life is as though he has destroyed the whole life. There are common values which we can work on and commit ourselves together. Religions are an energy of peace and justice, a barrier against the violent drift of the world. They can truly be a soul for the world, for a soulless world. And only soul can deal with the profound wounds that conflict, injustice, and the breach of human rights have generated. Thank you very much. 12 minutes, guys. I'm the best Italian there is.
Thank you very much. Next will be Dr. Anna Nardini, who is counselor to the Office of the Prime Minister and a Director General in the Presidency of the Council of Ministers in Italy. She received her law degree at the University of Rome, has researched in the Netherlands, and has worked in the Italian Foreign Ministry and the Directorate General for Emigration and Social Affairs. In the Prime Minister's office in Italy, she works on the international agreements between Italy and the Vatican, and ethics and human rights, and specific aspects of religious freedom. Dr. Nardini.
I prefer to speak from here. Sì, funziona. I want to thank Professor Durham to invite me to participate to this great conference, and I want to thank the Center of Studies. As some of know of that I'm here for an important event for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Italy, with a representative that in many years that we share together, we build not just professional relation, but also personal, because among the Mormons, I found wonderful people. At the event that I refer to, it is the approbation of the law in the July 2012 of the agreement between the Italian government and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in actuation of a specific article of our Constitution. I will specify these things a little bit later, but now I want to tell you that this law sees that the relationship between the state and the religion, which are not Catholic, are regulated by the agreement. These agreements are within the leaders of this church, specific church and the state. The Italian Constitution guarantees, through some norms that I will show you afterwards, the Italian Constitution sees a liberty of religion, both individually and socially. I think that freedom of religion in the human rights, it is central. And I like to remember the words of John Paul II, who sustained that the freedom of religion, it is so linked to the other fundamental right that you can see this as a test of all the other human rights. Now, let us see quickly what does the Italian law see. Before the Constitution in 1948, the Article 1 of the Albertine Charter in 1848 that was engraved also in the Italian Constitution, define the Catholic Church the only state church. And so we had a confessional state with just tolerance of other cults and religion. Therefore, we could not speak in terms of religion freedom. But notwithstanding that, as a privileged position of the Catholic Church, we started to have a separation between the Catholic Church and the state. In the following years, we see change within the state and the religion. That sees this at the end of the Lateran Charter that were signed in 1929. At the same way, in 1929, there was a law that disciplined the relationship for the admitted cult. So all the other religions were just admitted. We cannot see a proper freedom of religion, but only on January 1st in 1984 of our Republican Constitution, we recognize freedom of religion. And we saw that and clarified that in the time, not just with the Constitution, but by the interpretation of the Constitutional Court. This position of freedom of religion, I would like to quote the Article 8, first comma, and says, all confessions are equal in front of the law. The Article 19 see the freedom to profess one's belief individually to promote the diffusion and to proselyte. And then the Article 3, which is very important, it says that there should be no discrimination among the people for religion, race, or religion freedom. And the Article 20, this is a financial agreement. Then we also have constitutional articles that sees freedom of religion. For example, the Article 7 says that the state and the Catholic Church are both, in their order, independent, and they are related by the Lateran Charter. And as I said before, the third comma of Article 8 to regulate the different religions. The Constitution has also other articles that indirectly guarantee the freedom of religion. For example, the Article 2 that gives the right of human being, and the number 17, 18, and 19, that is the right of expression of an organization, so also organization of religious party. So these articles introduced a model that was started with the state and the Catholic Church, and now it's also extended to the other faith. Another thing that we need to say is that in this constitutional picture, the Constitutional Court intervened, and they made a presentation of this path was modified in the time with the society and with the perception of religion and human rights, worked both in the human nation and in the European nations. So, now I would like to go to talk about the disagreement. Now we need to say something first, a political thing. In the 60s, we felt the need, especially in the Italian Parliament, to modify the Lateranensian Charter. That because the society changed, there was the Ecumenical Council in the Vatican, we started to talk about divorce, and then divorce law was approved, and then there was a referendum where all the people could say if they wanted to keep this law or not. The law on divorce was kept, and this, with other events of the Italian society from the 60s on, made us understand that it was necessary to change the Lateranensian Charter and to keep it closer to our constitution, especially because in the Lateranensian Charter there was the principle coming from the Albertine Charter that the Catholic Church was the state religion. When we got to different draft, the process was very, very long. We got to, in 1984, and with the new agreement in 1984, the principle of state religion, Catholic religion as a state religion, was cancelled because it was not compatible with our constitution that, as I said, see the freedom of religion for every faith. At the same time, it was started a path to approve the first agreement between the Italian state, after 40 years after the constitution, to approve the agreement with the Valdese. And it's not by accident that the signature of this agreement started after 3 days after the change of the Lateranensian Charter. So after this first agreement, we had many more. There was one with the Assembly of God, with the Adventist of the 7 days, with the Union of the Jews in Italy, with the Union of the Baptists in Italy, with the Lutherans, with the Orthodox of Italy, with the Apostolic Church, with the Baptist, and with the, as I said before, with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I would like to say something about the procedure that are needed for this agreement. So it is the government that start this agreement. The confession who have legal status in a that refer to a law of 1929, they have to apply to the Prime Minister. So he gives mandate to the Secretary of the Council, of the Minister of Council. They have a commission that has to prepare a draft with the delegation of the religion and the faith that asked it for it. This council is formed by representatives of different administration, so not just the justice minister, economy minister, the university minister, cultural minister, and health minister. So the religion is represented by its leader. The commission is represented by a professor of constitutional law. On this draft, because it is made by leaders of the government, it is reviewed by another commission, the Commission of Consultation of Religious Freedom, which is formed by experts and academic and professors of ecclesiastic law, that they should check the possibility of problems in this agreement and to find solution for those. After this, the text, which is signed by both the state and the religion, goes to the parliament that should tell to the prime minister to sign this agreement with the representative of the religion. Then this text, it goes as a law proposition, and that has to be approved. So the path ends with the parliament making a law that is constituted by, except for a few exceptions, has the text of this agreement. The agreement that we had are both in the declarations, general declaration that should show the position of the church on specific topics. In fact, some people from the doctrine, they see these they see that these agreements, they're mostly similar to them. First of all, with the agreement, you have the religion has the opportunity to organize themselves and to call their own leaders without approbation from the state. Then there are norms and laws about spiritual welfare in the like in the armies or in the hospitals or in the jail. There's also laws about education so that they have the right to choose to not have the teaching of Catholic religion in the public school, but also to have their own religion teaching. It also gives the opportunity to recognize theological study of the faith. And the church can organize schools that will be recognized by the state. And also, there is the right to be married by a leader of the church. There are laws about the buildings of the religion, so the police cannot enter without notice. I see that I finished my time, and so I'll go very quickly. For example, there are norms regarding the possibility to minister. And so in the agreement of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we have a list of people who can actually celebrate marriage. In the agreement, there is a law that says that the religion can get some taxes from the state, but the Mormon Church in Italy decided to not have this right, and so it's not financed by the state. I'm sorry for the delay. I've finished. Then if I have more time, I would like to talk about something about the freedom of religion in Italy. Thank you.
Our last speaker is Dr. Andrea Pin, who is senior lecturer in constitutional and comparative law at the University of Padua, the oldest university in the world. And he's written books on human rights, law and religion, and comparative federalism. Dr. Pin.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. I'm really pleased to be here. And I am really impressed. Just let me thank you, not just for the invitation, but also because I had missed being babysit for 35 years before coming here. Because the students have been marvelous. And my impression is that Brigham Young University is not just great because of this level of scholarship, but also because the level of students, as well as the level of humanity that you can see in them. So I have the clear impression that you are committed to send great men and women, good men and women, to the world, and you accomplished that. And thanks for caravanning us throughout Salt Lake City and watching the movie and attending the Mormon conference, because that's the most beautiful explanation I could get of all your efforts. Coming to my presentation, I'll be short. Everything you think about Italians is true. So we wear good suits. We have nice food. We don't keep within time limits, and we carry a lot of crucifix. there was this famous crucifix case. I don't want to go through. I have been talking with Brad and Cole about these issues. It's interesting that each Italian classroom still displays a crucifix, and the display of a crucifix has been scrutinized by the domestic courts as well as by the European Courts of Human Rights. And I would like to explore the reasons behind the decision of the European Court of Human Rights, because I think that Europe is more in search of an identity rather than in search of a model through which human rights can be adjudicated. The domestic court said that the crucifix can stay, because it expresses state's neutrality. I didn't misspell that. It expresses state's neutrality, because neutrality and protection of religious freedom came from Christianity. So if we were to remove the crucifix, we will go against the roots of religious freedom and of state neutrality. And this is actually the edict of Milan heritage. You see, we keep tradition alive. And interestingly, when the case was brought before the European Court of Human Rights, on the first occasion, we were told that we should remove the crucifix. The second decision, the final decision, is interestingly different. The decision said that this is the quotation. I'm just going to read it because, so it can be translated. But the decision said, okay, you can keep it. It doesn't go against neutrality of a state. Why? Because Italy keeps a benevolent approach in the field of public education. Italian law currently conferred the right to wear Islamic headscarves and other apparel or symbols with a religious connotation. The beginning and end of Ramadan were often celebrated in schools. Religious instruction was permitted for all recognized creeds, and the needs of pupils belonging to minority faiths were taken into account, with Jewish pupils, for example, being entitled not to sit examinations on Saturdays. So, Italians are doing good, they can keep the crucifix. That was the basic, and this would go along with the idea of state neutrality. So this is the first lesson. You can keep your tradition. You don't need to cut your religious root as long as you expand religious freedom for others. This is the first lesson coming from European Karima rights with respect to the spread of the symbol. But there's more, which is the European Court of Human Rights, at the same time, using the same devices of state neutrality, has decided the opposite. Namely, it has decided that Muslim visible sign at school can be outlawed, and Muslim veil in public square can be outlawed. This happened in France, actually. But they are using the same category of neutrality. And neutrality was used in Switzerland to outlaw the minarets. And it legitimized the prohibition of the veil in French schools and Turkish universities. Different reasons, different countries, but there's a circulation of the same model of state neutrality. Well, the problem is that the European legal language is using the same category of neutrality to address several issues and with very different outcomes. How broad is the neutrality umbrella if you can both cover the display of crucifix and the ban of the headscarf? What are really trying to do through enforcing neutrality at the European level? That's the question I'd like to address. How many minutes do you have? 30 seconds? I have 7 minutes. Still, I can sell some. Okay. I'm okay. So the problem is that we are sticking to concepts that cannot really play a meaningful role in adjudicating human rights. Neutrality has been used for different purposes and led to very different outcomes. So why are we using that? My guess is that we're not using that because we're interested in adjudicating human rights. Such cases could have been solved without using neutrality. And the circulation of the idea of neutrality, which was influenced by the idea of separation of church and state, which came from the United States, as well by French separation of church and state and the Turkish separation of church and state, has other purposes. My guess is that we are trying to address the issue of European identity. What's the European identity, actually? Many thinkers believe that only a daring European mindset with a clear European identity would address issues of financial crisis, of the identity crisis, of immigration, of integration of new countries. And they are trying to find in the neutrality the principle that could gather all the countries around certain visible values, meaningful values. Well, There was an occasion in which this trend of reasons of reflections became extremely visible. It was during the debate of the European Union's constitution, early 2000, 2003, 2004, 2005. At that time, we were thinking about drafting a constitution for the whole Europe, the European Union. And at that time, we were thinking about preamble. There was a huge debate between those who wanted Christian roots to be included in the preamble. Well, many others said, guess what? No, if you want to treat each country equally, each citizen, European citizen equally, we need to stick to neutrality. And many thought that it was good. Many others thought, that's just a French model. And many others said, look, you cannot draw the line between Europe and its Christian heritage. Why? Because even the symbol of Europe has quite a religious origin. Yeah, that's what they said. They said that's the origin of a symbol. Well, there are speculations, of course, but I'm just giving you an idea of how broad was the debate at that time. Well, the constitutional project failed, not because of preamble. So we decided to go with a treaty, which is an international treaty, less daring, of course. But we are still talking about neutrality. And interestingly, neutrality cannot be found in the European Convention of Human Rights. This is a text. I will not read it, but the text doesn't say anything about neutrality. There's nothing like the American Establishment Clause. There's nothing like that. There's just a free exercise clause. How would you induce that the free exercise clause needs neutrality? Well, French would say it does. It does need neutrality. Some others wouldn't. Britons would say no. In fact, Britons have an established church, and they didn't want neutrality to be included in the drafting of the European Convention of Human Rights in the 50s, 40s and 50s. So we are still thinking about neutrality. And we're overlooking the idea that there's a religious pluralism, which is oftentimes quoted by the European Court of Human Rights in addressing these cases. The court says the state has a duty of neutrality and needs to protect religious pluralism. But we overlook religious pluralism and we stick to neutrality. Why we do that? Well, there's a reason for that. If you look into states' historical and constitutional identity, it would be hard to say that European states are religiously plural. They weren't religiously plural. We have a very distinct religiously connotated origin. Or not just from a demographic point of view, but even from a constitutional point of view. Each country in Europe decided what to do with its own religion, decided to endorse that, to conflict that, like France, to embrace that, to make an agreement with that, like Italy. But there was a clear religious majority, and it's still there. Let me just show you a few PowerPoints that can give you an idea of that. This is the 17th century. The colors are the religious denominations you can find. You could find at that time. No Mormons, but it's normal. That's 17th century. Now, you will not find them later, too. But
This is the 18th century, still there. Still there. The constitutions were evolving. States were evolving. I'm ending. Yeah, of course. I'm fine. This is contemporary Europe. Just majority, of course. We have growing minorities. But religious populations are still there. Just to give you a feedback, this is the patchwork of the United States. It's very different. In Italy, there's a clear Catholic connotation. You can simply cut it out. You can decide to fight against it, but it's still there. And that's why religious pluralism didn't work as a constitutional device from a demographic point of view or a social point of view. But religious pluralism can play a role at European level. Europe is not a state. It's behaving like it was a state. Let's just endorse a religious tradition, which is neutrality, which was born out of some constitutional models like France. Religious pluralism can be a device for Europe. Neutrality, I'm concluding with this, neutrality is an alternative to religious pluralism for Europe, but neutrality mainly goes along with the main wave of secularization of Europe. Let me just show the last PowerPoint. So the greener, the whiter is the most secularized. The greener is the most worshipping country. So you will have a conflict if you expect all European state to embrace the same state model and to have European legal culture that is embracing the same state model. Because what you have is different societies. So unless you find an umbrella which can reasonably address all these issues without losing a sense like neutrality is doing. Well, there will be a time when we'll say that established Church of England is neutral. It doesn't make much sense, but if you want just to fit it in the convention, you will need to do that. And my opinion is that what we have learned from the United States is that there's a separation of church and state, but it's intended to protect religious pluralism, not to enforce neutrality. That's the lesson we are still learning. And this is the gap between we have achieved and we should achieve, I think. And the example of Italy, which was said to protect in a benevolent way religious minority without cutting its religious loot, is a meaningful example for me. Thanks.
And this conference is celebrating the 1700th anniversary of the Edict of Milan. Now we have about 6 minutes for questions. Yes. Please speak your questions into the microphone.
I want to first introduce myself. I have a question to Mr. André. You talk about being unbiased, and you talk about it shall be free to wear a turban. I've been to Italy before as a tourist. I've been in Italy, like I've been to many cities. I haven't seen any mosque. I haven't heard the Islamic prayer. In Turkey, there are many churches, and you can hear their bells ringing. people, you know, they worship in every, they have religious freedom. You show the European map, but you show statistics, but there were no statistics about the Muslims. And does that mean that you don't accept the Muslim, you know, the presence, you know, in Europe?
This is a broader question, I could imagine. There are significant numbers of Muslims in Italy, which are not prevented from praying and for celebrating Ramadan. What we have now is sort of practical accommodation, because the agreements model hasn't been applied to the Muslim presence, mainly because we couldn't find a unified body of Muslim representatives. That's the Italian part of my answer. My answer about the Turkish presence in Europe is not jeopardized by the PowerPoints. I just used the PowerPoints because they were useful and to depict the historical heritage of Europe. But this doesn't prevent the Turkish from entering Europe. I didn't want to allude to these points. I take this as part of the questions. I think
I didn't just mention the Turkish only, the Muslims altogether. Yani, there were your statistics show all the religions, but except the Muslims. That's why I wanted to ask this question. So.
Andrea, ti faccio un chiarimento per quanto
riguarda. Sorry, but in Andrea's presentation, the presence, oops.
Yeah, the yellow is the Muslim part, right?
Islamic presence.
It's not out of Europe. It's just the yellow.
The majorities. I mean.
The majorities, just the statistical majorities. Anna Nardini would also like to speak on this point.
No, vorrei solo completare.
I would like to complete my talk because I didn't talk about the agreement with the Union of the Muslim in Italy. It has been many years that we have a relationship with these Islamic organizations. The most important one are the Islamic Cultural Center that has a legal status in Italy when they built the great mosque in Rome. So there are even other mosques in Milan, but there are thousands of places where the Muslim can pray, even if they are not built mosque. But we are still trying to have an agreement with the Muslim community. The problem is that one is the cultural center, the Islamic community in Italy, and the union of the Islam community in Italy. What we are missing, though, is a cohesion among these three great Muslim group in Italy, because Many times, as a government, we talked to them. We gave an indication on how they should organize themselves so that they can have one legal status altogether. So it has always been requested to all the religion that we had an agreement with. We cannot make an agreement with just one group, one minority group of these Islam, because there should be one leader for the whole Muslim people in Italy, and we know, we are aware of this problem.
You hear these things? I agree with you regarding being united. Not just the individuals are supported, but also everything is supported by the government. In Turkey, we give support to the minorities, and I'm hoping to see the same kind of support from the, you know, the government, the other governments in the Europe. So thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for attending the panel. Let's congratulate all the participants.